All right, so obviously last week we had the first part of this presentation, so introduction to pen testing presentation. So this is just the second part of it. So just a quick review that some of the ethical considerations of pen testing. We covered this last week, but because they're important, we'll cover it again just to remind you. They center on integrity, that is personal integrity. There's some of the better sources for what code of ethics you should be looking at are like the ISC squared code of ethics. These are basically protect the society, the common good, confidence, infrastructure. You need to act honorably, honestly, justly, responsibility, and legally, of course. You need to provide diligent, competent services to your clients, advance and protect the profession, and of course, provide privacy and confidentiality. And of course, one of the also very important things is getting written permission from appropriate authorities before you start trying to do pen testing. But basically, what it all boils down to is you need to be honorable when you do it. So, quick summary of the first part. Pen testing is when you look at for weaknesses in a systems to try to figure out how a hacker would look at it and try to figure out how to defend against the hacker before they ever get to the system. So it breaks down into three phases. Phase one is reconnaissance. We talked about this last week. This was passively learning about a target's network. This includes searching the web, even dumpster diving, as well as social engineering. Phase two is scanning. This is looking for technological openings in a network. This is where you look for access points of any sort, including things like open ports and existing back doors. So you might do like war dialing or war driving in this case. I guess you could do that in recon. Well, no, that's scanning. And then there's exploits. Last week we only talked about OS exploitations, which are where you gain control over individual machines. Some of the main things we talked about there were buffer overflows and password guessing, and also how you automate everything. Specifically, we talked a little bit about Metasploit. The other part of phase three, which we'll get into in a minute, is network attacks. After that, phase four is maintaining access, which is basically making sure that I can get back on a machine. Yeah, I know that none of these are on the slide. These are maintaining access is generally going to be like malware, so that's where you insert backdoors. And then finally, phase five is where you cover your tracks, removing evidence, stuff like that. Are there any questions, especially for the people who didn't make last week? So, network attacks, like I said, this is the second part of getting into a system. So, just as a little overview, sniffing can reveal sensitive information. Sniffing is just when you get on and you grab packets from the network directly. Can be made worse by ARP or DHCP poisoning, which we'll get into in a little bit. Session hijacking, which allows an attacker to take over a communications channel. Denial of service or DOS attacks take down services. A DOS attack goes beyond just taking down a service. You can actually use it as part of improving on another attack. And again, we'll talk about that as we go along. So, intruder access to getting a network. That's the part where you actually try to get within the network and take over things. So, once you have access to a network, there's a lot of ways to attack systems on it. One is to perform session hijacking, which I think I talk about in a few slides. So, I won't go into great detail on it just yet. Another is spoofing ARP, which is the Address Resolution Protocol. DHCP, which I can't remember what that stands for, but that's the thing that assigns IP addresses. Instead of doing it statically, that's when you connect to, say, a router, and it says, okay, you get this IP address. And DNS, which is the service that allows you to resolve website addresses to IP addresses. So you can also, without necessarily even spoofing any of these three protocols I mentioned, you can spoof a legitimate network service. And finally, as I mentioned before, you can perform sniffing to get information that's traveling across the wire. So, starting to get more in depth on things, network sniffing, which I've already mentioned twice, so you know it's important. That's when you flat out bypass the networking stack to read packets directly. Now, when I say the stack, that's the network stack. What it does is it handles how you interpret the packets that you get. So you get an IP packet, which encapsulate it within that will usually have either TCP or UDP, which encapsulate it within those usually has application data. So a network stack basically takes you from the IP level, grabbing it straight off the network, and delivers that information to a application. So sniffing allows you, even though you're not the application that it was directed to, it lets you get the packets directly. Sniffing can be performed either by a compromised machine on the network, so something that we compromised in the first half of this, which would be an OS exploit, or it can be actually on an attacker's machine. So, for instance, if I found an open wireless access point or I was able to plug into a port, I can then perform sniffing on the network.
A question there, Eugene. Would it be difficult to get to sniff that the traffic coming to that computer if you had access to just like a USB port and you plug it in or whatever you would plug into the machine?
I guess it really depends on what you mean. I mean, one
Like,
interpretation of that would be that you're talking about a network adapter that's going over USB, but I don't think that's what you mean.
what I mean is, like, you said that one way to do that would be to convert. To basically overtake the OS, right?
Yeah.
That would be, I would think, quite difficult to do.
Not necessarily. Remember, there's this little operating system called Windows.
But I guess the point is, like, if you have physical access, is
If you have
that.
physical access, that computer is screwed.
Okay.
If you have physical access, if nothing else, I mean, there are certain instances where it might take a lot of effort anyway, but your average system, if you have physical access, you can get into that system if you want to. You can run password crackers. You could just flat out install your own operating system over the top of it. For that instance, for that matter, you could just run it off of USB. There's a lot of things you can do with physical access.
Choice would be to install a background program that runs when the operating system starts, because that way nobody can
Well,
tell that any change has occurred to the computer.
specifically, that would be more like a rootkit, which we have discussed.
Yeah.
Because generally, you can detect a regular old virus, but a rootkit, on the other hand, is all about hiding itself.
Exactly.
So anyway, let's see. Obviously, I mentioned that you have to be able to get onto the network first. And like I said, one of the ways to do that is having your own machine. So one thing to keep in mind is that one of the ways to get your machine on that network is to use social engineering, which is just go in and talk your way in. So you might convince Luke that you're a coherent laser technician.
Yes.
And he'd let
You're
you in, and
coherent.
you'd get in the building,
You
and
sound coherent. You
obviously
can
I'm qualified, yeah.
tell.
So anyway, yeah, our poor audience that will not get that joke. Anyway,
There's a company called Coherent. It makes lasers.
if you're within the network, then you can basically bypass pretty much any network protection using a sniffer. There are technically a few that can be used at that, but most commonly network protections operate at a higher level, like usually application level. So unless you pretty much manually program your switch or hub, that well, switch hubs, you don't have a choice. You can't do much. Anyway, if you're sniffing, you can generally read plain text or just even weakly encrypted communications. And unfortunately, a lot of protocols do still run over plain text, even though they could really easily be using encryption. And of course, I mentioned, switches. The distinction between a switch and a hub, well, I'll get to that in a minute. Basically, you can use art poisoning to reduce the security of a switch. And like I said, we can talk about that in a few minutes. So the interesting thing is to increase the level at the IP level, you can use the level of protection at the IP level, you can use MAC address filtering. Unfortunately, using ARP, I can generally get around that, and it's really hard to do good MAC address filtering. And yeah. Anyway, why is this such a big problem? Well, obviously, a network attack may flat out allow me to get access to a computer. For instance, if a password is passed unencrypted across the network or it's weakly encrypted, I may be able to gain a password that way. Also, just flat out because I may not need to compromise a machine because I may be able to get all the data. Like if I'm from a competing company, I may be able to get all your data that you're trying to protect, all your designs or whatever, and take them back, and we can reverse engineer them and really quickly because we have all the data originally there and use it to attack. Or to, get a new product out before you. So, are there any questions about network sniffing, excluding art poisoning? Because I'll get to it in a minute. All right. So, art poisoning. What is art poisoning? Well, first of all, I should explain switches and hubs. A hub is what came first in networking. A hub lets you plug in a whole bunch of different Ethernet cables into a single device. And what that hub does is it basically it takes every packet that is passed into it and it broadcasts it to everything else plugged into that hub. Obviously, if I'm connected to a hub, anyone can plug into that hub and sniff traffic. Hubs don't provide anything in the way of security for that. Now, the switch, on the other hand, generally what they do is they learn the network configuration, and once they've learned it, they will broadcast only on the port that is associated with the correct IP address. Now, you can't actually, well, you can actually increase the security of your network a little bit if you hard code in, go manually set these tables to say that this port is associated only with this IP address. But obviously, if you've got, 1,000 people on one network, Nobody wants to do that. All right, so then the next thing I need to explain, because probably not everybody knows it, is ARP. ARP is the Address Resolution Protocol. What generally happens with ARP, well, ARP obviously is trying to say, okay, this MAC address is associated with this IP address. So what normally happens is if I want to send out a packet and I'm looking for the right MAC address to send it to, I'm going to say, hey, who has this MAC address? And then the person who owns it responds and says, well, me, this is my MAC address, send here. ARP poisoning uses what's called a gratuitous broadcast. So this is part of the protocol, you know, it's part of the standard, but what it's doing is instead of waiting for somebody to ask, it says, hey, I'm this MAC address and I own this IP address. So obviously if I can do that and everybody will accept that, then I can pretend to be any IP address I want because everyone will send to my MAC address. Now obviously this could be fixed if anyone was willing to update the address resolution protocol, but that's really expensive. So once you do ARP poisoning, your switch might as well be a hub. So let's see. ARP poisoning, like I said, you know, I just explained that. Because we can use that broadcast, we can rewrite the mapping of ports. What is interesting about it as well is just because I've rewritten that mapping of ports does not mean that the real owner of the IP address cannot get any packets. Because what I can actually do is I can start acting like a router. I can take the packets I've received that were supposed to go to that that other IP address and then resend them using the correct MAC address. And then I'm actually performing what's called a man-in-the-middle attack, which is really common. And, you know, that's unpleasant because it means I can be sniffing your traffic without you knowing about it. I can even start modifying your traffic, and you'll never know about it because you don't know I'm there. Anyway, the good thing about ARP poisoning the relief is that it only affects LANs. This does not work if you're going over the internet. There are nasty tricks you can do over the internet. We're not going to get into depth on, like, talking about how you can compromise DNS, because that really comes down to doing an OS exploit on the DNS server and then poisoning the DNS that way. Are there any questions on ARP poisoning? All right, so session hijacking. Well, that's when you take over an existing session, an existing channel between two machines. So if I've got, say, a Telnet session up and running, well, Telnet's not encrypted, so I might be able to do ARP poisoning and get that Telnet session to be pointing towards me, and I just take it over and pretend that I'm either the controller or the recipient. Now, because that Telnet session has already been authenticated, I mean, there's nothing stopping me from doing that. So obviously, this is really easy to do on unencrypted channels. Like I said, I sit around waiting for it to be authenticated, for those two machines to establish a session, and then I knock one of the parties offline. Aside from ARP, this is where I can also use a denial of service attack that I mentioned before. If I can take somebody offline, then session hijacking becomes more powerful, whether I'm using ARP or regular DOS. And I can also, in theory, sort of do session hijacking on a truly encrypted channel. So an example of that would be like if I did a DOS attack on a SSH server and then did ARP poisoning to pretend to be that server, and somebody reconnected to me, right? So that person reconnects to me, even though it says I have a new key. A lot of people just say, well, even though this is warning me that it's not the same key, I'm going to trust it anyway. So they type in yes, and it does require you type YES, not just Y. And there you go, you've just connected. So what if I don't know your real password? I just modified the SSH server binary not to care what the password is. Suddenly I've intercepted your SSH connection. Granted, in this case, it's only replacing the server I can do. I really can't replace the client. Questions?
When you say session, what exactly does that mean?
Okay, so I'll try to work from an example because I think it'll be easier. Have you used Telnet? Are you familiar with what Telnet is?
No, I'm not.
So are you familiar with SSHs?
Yeah.
So you know how SSH is encrypted and everything?
Right.
Telnet is not.
Okay.
The reason why I'm telling you Telnet is because we can talk about hijacking more if we need to there.
Right.
So Telnet, you send a password over, just like an SSH. You connect, and you send a password over.
Yeah.
So that password allows you to authenticate to that server. You say, I am this user. So once you've done that, you've started a session because you've set up a channel. So that's your session.
I see.
So obviously, if I hijack a session, I've taken over that channel. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, so you know, I talked a little bit about a few defenses from sniffing and hijacking. One is to use strong authentication protocols. That basically only defends you from hijacking. So you know, obviously a password is nice, but if it's only 8 characters and it's a regular word, well, anybody can get that within a few minutes. On the other hand, if I were to say use RSA keys, public private keys, to do my authentication, well, that's actually going to be pretty hard to trick, because that is mathematically hard to figure out what the proper key should be. You can encrypt sessions. When you encrypt the sessions, you should encrypt them for both confidentiality and integrity. Now, what that means is that I want to make sure nobody can read this session, so that protects against sniffing, but I also want to make sure that nobody can tamper with this session, so that means I can't do session hijacking. Also, you should want to make sure it's an authenticated channel, which means that you maintain the proof that each side is who they claim they are throughout the entire thing. Technically, you can use one-way authentication too, depending on the circumstances. But anyway, another thing you can do, I mentioned this a little bit, is when you manually map addresses to specific ports on switches. Like I said, that's really hard to do. I can envision a situation in which when you first set up the network, you let it pick it up automatically, and then you tell it to freeze everything, and then you manually add new users. I guess it depends on how dynamic your switch is, your network is. Also, obviously, if you have people carrying around laptops, this doesn't work very well, because then they're changing ports all the time. So finally, the obvious thing is make sure attackers don't get on the network. You do this by using intrusion detection systems and firewalls. And finally, the thing I say every time, user education. So any questions? All right, so finally, we'll talk a little bit about denial of service. This is the act of preventing legitimate access to a service. This can be performed locally, so arguably we could have included this in the OS area, but most of the time the stuff you hear about is at the network level because of DDoS attacks. Anyway, this requires the attacker to actually have either physical access or an exploit that allowed them access to the targeted machine. However, like I said, many network versions of DDoS attacks exist. The thing you hear about in the news all the time are DDoS attacks. That's distributed denial of service attacks. These just coordinate a whole bunch of machines all at once. The simplest of these, literally, they just have so many machines on so many different connections that they overwhelm the bandwidth of the target. Questions? So I talk a little bit about variants. Well, I've already mentioned DDoS attacks. Like I said, these are often botnets, and they're all just out there hammering a single target. A TCP flood, this is a little bit more interesting. So the TCP standard protocol, when you first initiate a TCP connection, you do a handshake. What the handshake is I send a request to initiate the connection, the server responds, and it says, okay, we'll do that. And then I respond back and say, yes, I'm confirming that I'm completing the handshake and that I'm about to send you data. So what a TCP flood is basically I send a whole bunch of requests to the target, never bother completing the handshake. So generally, TCP floods, or TCP state is tracked with a stack in memory. So what happens here is that stack literally just gets overflown. Alternatively, well, I talk about the protection in a few minutes, so I won't get into that. So are there questions on there? Because that's a little bit more complex than just a DDoS. Then there's a teardrop attack. This uses non-standard fragments on packets. Basically, the result is sometimes the network stack on some operating systems doesn't handle fragmenting quite right, and so it freaks out. There's other variants of this that manipulate stuff like that. Teardrop is just a really easy one to describe, but lots of them target, there's just a mistake on the network stack, and as a result, I'm able to take down the computer or at least slow it down.
Don't most of the newer systems, since the bandwidth is so large these days, most newer systems, it would seem, could just simply reject all packets that don't fit their hash?
Well, the thing is you have to be able to reject the packet. You have to know that it's a problem. To do that, you have to do a certain amount of processing on it. If the processing is done poorly and it causes a problem, and since, remember, the network stack is what does the processing, then it's still a problem. Now, you might be able to block it with an IDS, yes. Now, I don't remember if I talk about this much in the defense, but if you want to know more details, let's come back to it when we hit the defense section. But I think I pretty much just summed up. And finally, there's redos. This uses malicious regular expressions to consume processing power. So basically, one of the obvious ones, you know, this might cause an infinite loop, right? But so one of the obvious ones is because a lot of systems connected to the internet, you know, that are web servers especially, process XML, you might be able to figure out a way to make them get stuck. So because when I say they process, they use like XQuery, which is a fairly full-featured language. And yeah, you might just be able to figure out a transform that you can convince them to do that they get stuck on forever. I've seen this happen. It's ugly. Any questions? All right, so some of the defenses. A DDoS attack, basically this requires coordination from an ISP. You either get a whole bunch of bandwidth, which is really expensive, or the ISP has to filter it. Even if the ISP filters this, you know, if they can detect it, even then the ISP could potentially go down if it was a big enough botnet that was coordinated against you. Either way, honestly, if you get a targeted DDoS attack against you, you're probably going down, unless you're a huge company with a lot of resources. So TCP flooding, you have to drop open connections, say, after a certain period of time. You could even not store them in memory. So the alternative is there's a version of TCP that uses stateless connections. So what it does is it sends a hash that is using a secret key that is stored on the server, and the server forgets about it, so it doesn't store it in memory, and it waits for the client to send the cookie back, the hash back with their handshake. So if the completed handshake is sent back with the correct hash, and that hash verifies, then you know it's a valid connection, so you go ahead and let the connection start. However, it takes a lot of CPU to do this, so in reality, all you've done is push the problem around to a new spot. Any questions?
As far as defending the DDoS attack defense,
oh, I forgot to
coordinating with ISP,
yeah.
I don't know if I need this more clarified to me, just because I didn't quite understand it or not, but basically my question amounts to, couldn't any particular DDoS attack, as long as it's not explicitly utilizing the domain name, just simply redirect to a different IP address, simply tell all the DNS servers, don't use this IP address anymore, it's not legit, it's been DDoS attacked, this IP address.
And that
instead.
Is true, but that does require, DNS, the reason why I didn't mention that specific is, yes, if it's like a 4-hour long attack, sure, DNS takes a long time to update usually.
Okay.
This comes from painful experience of update, point to my site again.
Yeah.
It can take like 4 hours sometimes. That's usually the limit, but it can take like 4 hours. You got to remember, it's refreshing through this huge chain of things.
Uh-huh.
But yes, in theory, you could do that. Like I said, generally the attacker can just readjust and start attacking the new address. So that's not as good as the two I mentioned, but like I said, generally you're just screwed.
Yeah.
Anyway, finally, redos attacks. Basically, this means that you have to make sure that your service will not attempt to evaluate malicious expressions. So this really boils down to check your inputs. And that's something, it's the same thing as you have all the time, you know, in the exploits that we talked about for the OS level. You have to make sure that it won't get evaluated. Any other questions? All right. So phase four, this is really brief, because basically phase four has been covered when I gave the malware talk. If you missed that one, it's online. It's not as good quality audio as I'd like, but oh well. Anyway, basically maintaining access is all about, once you've already gotten into the system, you want to make sure that you can get back into the system. So you might install a backdoor to allow the attacker to get back in. A botnet is actually a type of backdoor. They're creating distributed networks by using backdoors. A rootkit hides the control software used for maintaining control. The other interesting thing is, a lot of times, one of the first things a lot of hackers will do is they'll get in and they will actually lock down the security on the computer so that nobody else can use the same exploits or any other exploits to take over that computer. Are there any brief questions on this? All right, so phase five is removing evidence. So this is something that you'll find, if you go look in some resources, they don't bother covering it. They say, well, you shouldn't need to know this as a pen tester. However, since part of defending a system is about determining what an attacker has done and if you've in fact been attacked, and for that matter, if possible, sending law enforcement to them, I argue that it's good to know about this particular phase as well. So anyway, this is basically when you're going back and you're cleaning things up. One obvious thing is to remove log files or edit them so that they don't show traces of your attack. Covert channels are nifty, because what they can do is they can use protocols in unexpected ways to send information back to the attacker. And you can also use relays to hide the attacker's location. So the first one is modification of computer log files. They're generated by system processes and applications to record system activity. They're really useful for when you're troubleshooting a system, but they're also good for looking for inappropriate activity on a system, like when you've been hacked. Obviously, an attacker's just going to try to modify them, like I said, to try to remove any traces of their activities. And here's just a screenshot of the Windows security event log. I'm not going to go into detail on it because they're pretty straightforward, and to go into detail because they do some interesting things, but it would be a whole presentation in and of itself. So are there any questions about the removing log files? So some of the defenses, well, the most obvious one is write-only media. So this is media that, at least from the source you're using, you can write to it once, but you can't modify it. And when I say modify it in this case, I mean you can append to it. So maybe what I should have said is append, but you cannot come back and read it out and change things within the log. Another thing would be an access control list, or also known as ACL. These are generally, just is a Windows term if memory serves. Anyway, this assigns permissions to access to Office, to objects. So basically that's all about setting the correct permission for your log files. A remote log server, so that's when you have a whole different computer that receives input from other computers and records it as logs. And backing up system logs to separate media, so like a DVD, for instance. Any questions? Didn't think so. Really straightforward. All right, so the next thing you can do are hidden files and covert channels. So hidden files are files that are generally out of sight, or they're just hard to find. So in Windows, you go to the hidden you can select a hidden attribute under the Properties tab for the file or folder that you're working on. In Unix and Linux, all you have to do is prepend a dot to the file name, and that hides it from what you normally look at. So anyway, a hidden file, it's pretty obvious what you might want to use here. You can use it for storage for attacks. You can also store information sniffed from the network or recovered from the system you're using there. Are there questions on hidden files before I hit covert channels? All right, so covert channels, I think these are absolutely fascinating. So these are when you are making a path of communication out of a computer using a mechanism that a developer just flat out did not intend. So these are entirely hidden from any sort of access controls because there's no way for a developer to have anticipated these. You can't really detect them or control them by hardware security, and they can be used to tunnel through secure operating systems. They're not to be confused with legitimate channel exploitation, which are just using like stenography to disguise prohibited objects within legitimate objects. So that's where you're hiding something within it, but you're not necessarily totally changing the way the channel was intended to be used. So when do these things exist? Just to give you a better definition, a sender and a receiver have to have a shared resource. So an obvious shared resource would be like a network channel. But another shared resource would be, for instance, if we both could read the permissions on a file and I am a high-level user, I could actually just flip the permissions bits on a file and use that as a very slow communications method down to a lower-level person who can see if they can read or write that file. So I think that's a really nifty concept for a covert channel. There are also other ones. There's also side channel attacks, which we're not really going to get into, and they're related to covert channels. There's a huge overlap. Communication can be synchronized between the sender and receiver. That's another one of the conditions for a covert channel that exists. And finally, of course, system administrators should not be able to detect these under normal circumstances. The big downside to a covert channel is generally they are really, really slow. However, because they don't get detected, generally these channels will maintain access and you'll be able to continue receiving the data you want. You might also use them to control a system. So you could send commands, shell commands, over a covert channel back to the target machine. All right, before I hit the examples, are there any questions? All right, so just as some examples, you can use Internet Control Message Protocol, ICMP, to do some tunneling through that. So this includes, for instance, ping. Now the thing about ICMP is it is absolutely, I guess not absolutely because it's a little bit above art, but it's low level. So it does not get interpreted very much by the network stack because it's not TCP or UDP, there's no ports, there's nothing. So generally ICMP is just ignored. You get a ping, you send a ping response. You get a trace route, you get send back the right response. As a result, it tends to be ignored. So what you do there, it bypasses the firewall generally as well, because like I said, it tends to get ignored. So what generally happens here is with ping, for instance, it can have a payload attached to it. There can be a whole bunch of stuff appended to it that will not be processed by anything using ping legitimately, but it also doesn't cut it off. So I can send traffic like commands, even if I want, in the clear, and probably nobody's going to notice it unless they're specifically looking for it, in which case, if I've got a sniffer running on the target machine, then I can sniff that ping packet, and grab the data from it and interpret it and use it as a command. Also, obviously, I can send data with that. So there's a rather old application at this point called Loki. We didn't actually find a lot of new ones. We looked. But anyway, Loki can use either UDP or ICMP. Like I said, it tunnels it in odd ways. It actually can support Blowfish encryption because this was back before AES was around and DES was kind of weak at the time. And it can use Diffie-Hellman to do asymmetric encryption. Also, there's CCT, which is Covert Channel Tunneling Tool, and MSN Shell. Now, before I hit reverse WWW shell, I'll just give another example off the top of my head of a way to do a covert channel in TCP. So just so you have more than one example, because I personally think it's somewhat of a confusing topic for people. So in TCP, you've got a header, and that header has things like a hash that says, you know, this if this hash verifies, then that's what this message is still untampered with, valid, right? So let's say I go in and I replace the value on a hash, and I send that TCP message. Well, as a sniffer, I can read that TCP message and I can retrieve the hash value. As a network stack, because that's not a valid hash value, I'm just going to drop that message. So nobody ever sees what I actually sent. And thus, I've just created a covert channel. So I'll talk a little bit about reverse WW shell real quick. So obviously, this is using the HTTP protocol. So I've hit ping, so ICMP. I've hit TCP, so I've gone up another layer in the stack, and now we're hitting application layer. So this can allow internal network from the outside. Obviously, this is providing a shell. This requires installation of a program on the network, obviously, but that's to be expected. So what it's doing is it connects, say, generally every 60 seconds to a master server out somewhere and pulls traffic down from it. So it's actually a web server that it's connecting to, and it pulls it from there, and it tries to see if there are command updates there. Now, the nice thing about this is because most organizations allow you access to the internet and they generally filter using a blacklist, you can just go pull from this server and it'll get commands. So it's really hard to detect unless you have either a good IDS that knows what to look for or you've got your filtering that's done for your IP addresses that you can connect to done smartly, which is really unusual. All right, questions?
I was just thinking about the hash filtering issue. How late is that in the game? I mean, how could you get a channel if you know your packet's going to be filtered out?
You're talking about TCP?
Yeah.
So the sniffing bypasses the stack. It's basically providing its own stack. So the network stack, the legitimate network stack rejects it. But as a sniffer, I've gotten it already. So basically, I'm telling the Ethernet adapter, send me the same packets you send to the stack. So send everything to me as well as to the regular stack.
Okay, so
I'm just getting a copy.
You're getting a copy of it before it has the opportunity to throw out that packet.
Exactly. So I've already got a copy of it. Anything else?
Would there be any way for the person being attacked to maybe make sure that no program on the computer has the right to do something like that?
Well, I mean, yes, but this is assuming that the attacker's already somehow gotten this type of software installed and has had all the rights. Yes, if you harden your computer correctly, and like I said, one of these days we'll do a presentation on that, but it's a presentation in and of itself.
Hardening the computer a little bit more. Okay.
Yes, you can prevent it, but in the end, somebody can always hack a computer, and if they can get the right access, then they can get this running. Well, technically, you could air gap your computer, but Iran showed us that that doesn't work if you're willing to allow USB drives, hence Stuxnet, because that was an air gap facility. Any other questions? All right, so some of the defenses against hidden files, I didn't talk about my favorite part on hidden files. I guess I'll talk about that real quick before we hit the defenses. So there's a particular thing called alternate data streams, ADS, in NTFS. So an alternate data stream just allows me to associate data with a file, but in Windows, there's absolutely nothing that can read an alternate data stream. I don't know why they included it in here, but nothing can read it in Windows. You can write a program that can read it, but you can't actually read it. Now, if you're using an alternate data stream, the file size does not change. There's no indication that there's an extra data stream in there. Nothing. So this is really popular with old viruses. Now it's usually defended against. I have a suspicion that antiviruses probably watch for ADS use as a heuristic, but I could be wrong. Anyway, so that would be a hidden file type. Are there questions about ADS? Because I think it's really cool. Nope, you guys aren't any fun.
I guess my question is, how far can that go? I mean, are you just talking about hard drive connection only, or can that be...
This is at the file system level.
Okay.
It's so... part of the NTFS file system.
Okay. It's still Microsoft.
So then it has to be on
file system.
Yeah, and I was just NTFS. Highly redundant because NTFS stands for New Technology File System, but anyway.
Okay, well, if it's NTFS, then it goes through the hard drive, right? I mean, that's going to be traveling through the SATA cable at some point.
Yes, but the place you would want to block that is not at the hard drive level. You'd want to block that at the OS level. It's a driver issue.
Okay.
Because file system is dealt with in the OS level, it sets up the hard drive to use a specific file system, and the OS has to know how to read it for the file system. That's not dealt with by the OS, by the hard drive.
So the hard drive is not going to be able to understand that kind of application layer.
Yeah, that layer of abstraction lives on the OS, not on the hardware.
Okay.
A lot lives on the hardware, but that's not part of it.
Okay.
Any other questions on that?
So is that, I found a thing a while back where you can put a file inside of a picture. Is that specifically what that is?
No, that would be stenography.
No, you literally put a file inside of a picture.
I'm aware of that. That would be stenography. That's where you tweak values, pixels within that picture so that it is not apparent.
No, there's a command line thing you can do on Windows. It's really easy.
Okay, well then it might be that you don't have to use that. It could be that you are correct because you said picture. I would automatically assume stenography, but if that's true,
well, just I guess it's any file.
That's what I was gonna say. If that's true, then yes, there might be a way to do it. I sure didn't think they had a way to do it. Oh, I guess maybe they do from command line.
Well, you can't extract it. You can only put it in.
Oh, figures.
You have to use something like WinRAR to get it out.
That could be it. I would have to see the command and I'd have to see the context. You had something.
How do you guarantee that your hidden ADS data is not overwritten?
Your hidden ADS data? Sorry. Well, technically you can't, right? But so that ADS data, it's given a name, so that stream is named. But the other thing to keep in mind is almost nobody uses ADS. So the likelihood of anyone even using ADS is so low that it probably won't ever get touched by anything other than your nasty files.
I actually remember why Microsoft put this in. Microsoft did it originally to try to give the integration with the Mac OS system.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I read about it. Yeah. Microsoft, remove legacy. Remember that legacy stuff. Anyway, any other questions?
Yeah, I mean, I guess ADS, it could ultimately at some point in time get overwritten by your hard drive just simply filling up, but the likelihood of that is slim to none.
Nope. So because it's a legitimate file structure, so the hard drive will not override it.
But you say that the size of the file won't change. It'll stay the same.
No, the reported size of the file will not change. Windows says it's the same size, but it's actually larger.
So
if you can access things at a lower level than normal, you can actually see that it's a larger file size.
So let's say, for instance, that I use ADS and I store a gigabyte of data there, and my hard drive is, I don't know, 20 gigabytes in size. I'll be able to notice that discrepancy when I go to see how much space is left on my hard drive.
Yeah, because those of us who are using terabyte hard drives really care enough to track down to the gigabyte level. Yes, in theory, you can notice it. Basically, yeah, there should be an anomaly that shows up if you can go at a low enough level and get the file size.
Yeah,
it depends on what reporting tool you're using. Also, if you used Linux, it may show up there. I'm not sure. I've never really played with it.
I think probably the whole file would be... I mean, if you did...
I guess you have a presentation to go work on, Luke.
Yeah.
Do a demo and a presentation on ADS.
And ADS, okay.
I think it would be a great one. But I really don't want to rat hole on it because I don't actually know much about ADS. I've never used it directly.
Okay.
I've just read about it.
Oh, okay.
Anything else?
Yeah, so that thing I was talking about, it's a lot simpler than that. I mean, you can append the binary into a JPEG.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you see the file size of it.
Oh, so it's appending. Okay, so it's, okay, so.
You're literally copying the bytes into the.
Yeah, so that's not the same thing then.
Yeah.
Okay. So for hidden files, you can protect this with like file integrity checks. So that's like keeping a hash tracked of it somewhere and using an internal intrusion detection system. For a covert channel, using an antivirus can help. Intrusion detection systems, again, may be able to notice that there's something screwy going on the network. And of course, keeping your systems patched and up to date. There is really no effective defense once an attacker has access to your computer, because they can turn off most of the defenses depending on how much they have. And you can manually remove it once you find it. The best defense, keep the attackers out in the first place. So, you know, hardening your system, user education, who would have thunk? I think that pretty much sums it up. Any questions? Kind of worries me that nobody asks about the defenses. They're all just hoping to break into Luke's lasers. All right, so anyway, just a little brief example. I won't try to run a demo on it because it would take a while to set that up. You can use relays to conceal the source location of an attack. So I think this is pretty straightforward. An attack from A to B can be routed through a whole bunch of different outside machines. So if I can compromise 15 different machines between me and A and B, then, you know, I could use all of them to route my communications through. And if I'm really nasty, I'll make sure it goes through different jurisdictions, because as you can imagine, if I place something in Palestine and something in Israel, it's going to be really hard to trace it across the two because they hate each other so much. An indirect attack is obviously going to be harder to trace than a direct attack because I have to go back through and look at all the log files. Questions? So like I said, we could actually do a demo on this, but I really don't feel the...
I just got a question about that jurisdictional issue there. If you want to set up, like, with the example between Israel and Palestine, if you're in Israel, is it in general going to be harder to access computer systems that are, you know, in Palestine?
Well, if you're already willing to break laws and everything, probably not much.
Okay.
Yep, I can't tell you... if either Israel or Palestine have, say, any sort of country-level offenses, like honestly a lot of countries in that region have, even then you can probably bypass those easily because they're not usually very good.
Okay. Or, like, I'm sure there's such restrictions on, like, who visits Chinese web servers and things like that.
Yeah, but all those things can be bypassed. Actually, thank in part the U.S. State Department, which has been funding efforts like that.
I see.
Any other questions? All right, so just as an example of a relay, is Netcat. Now, we've talked about Netcat before because it can be used to set up a shell. Netcat, for the people who don't know, is just, it's been called the Swiss Army knife of networking. Basically, you can connect to any two machines and you can send data with no formatting added across TCP or UDP connections. So on the relay machine, you'll run the command mknod buffer p. So that's just creating a special file that can act as a buffer. On the same machine, you then run a netcat command, so nc-l-p with the receiving port, and then you tell it to send to the buffer, and you do a pipe, and you tell nc, then destination IP, then send port, and then you tell it to read from the buffer. And like I said, this basically what it does is it takes the traffic it receives from the first port and IP address and sends it along to the other IP address. Questions? All right, finally, just some conclusions. Well, first of all, you know, same reason we've hit you twice now with the ethics, is it requires adherence to a code of ethics. Pen testing is good to help you find holes in your system before the attackers can find them and exploit them themselves. And it's divided into five phases: reconnaissance, scanning the target, exploits and compromises, maintaining control, and removing evidence. Questions? Finally, a handful of references and links. CounterHack Reloaded is a great book. It's by Ed Skotus. It's actually used as the textbook for at least one of the information assurance classes in the CPE department here. Nmap.org has some good stuff. Firewalk at Packet Storm Security. Packet Storm Security in general is an interesting resource. The Nessus Vulnerability Scanner. Those three things are all things that I had brought up, I think, entirely in the first half of the presentation. ISC Squared Code of Ethics. The EC Council had additional ethics. And finally, OWASP has a whole bunch of different stuff. That's Open Web Application Security Project. They've, for obvious reasons, cover a lot of stuff in security. And of course, thanks to Nate O'Neill, Luke Burgess, and John McCann for contributing to the slideshow.